All right, so we're diving into some pretty fascinating stuff today, some fascinating material you shared with me, these lectures by Dr. Marv Wilson on the prophet Amos.
Yeah, Amos is amazing.
We're talking 8th century D.C.
Yeah.
But guess this, Amos was tackling issues that are still so relevant today, social justice, wealth inequality.
Right.
Like what it really means to be a good person. You'll be surprised how much his world mirrors our own.
Yeah, I think that's what's so striking is the audacity of this guy, you know, to imagine just like a shepherd,
right,
used to the quiet rhythms of nature,
mm-hmm,
and then suddenly he's thrust into the heart of a society wrestling with these big questions. And that contrast, I think the simplicity of his background against the complexity of these issues,
right,
is really central to Amos's message.
It's like stepping out of a time machine and finding yourself in the middle of like a really heated debate about,
yeah,
the same things we're still arguing about today.
Absolutely.
So, okay, so for those of us who need a refresher, who was Amos,
sure,
where does he fit into the whole biblical narrative?
So he wasn't a household name, at least not in the traditional sense.
Okay.
Dr. Wilson describes him as a shepherd from Tekoa,
okay,
which is a town south of Jerusalem,
mm-hmm,
in the southern kingdom of Judah. But God calls him to prophesy in the northern kingdom of Israel. And you have to remember,
right,
after King Solomon's death, the kingdom split. And there was a lot of tension between those two.
Okay, right. Yeah. So he's sent from the south to the north.
Exactly.
Two kingdoms that weren't exactly on speaking terms.
Right.
Okay. So this already sounds like we're headed for conflict.
You could say that. And it gets even more interesting because Amos was sent specifically to Bethel.
Bethel.
Which was a major religious center in the north. But here's the catch.
Okay.
Bethel was home to this controversial golden calf worship.
Wait, golden calf? That rings a bell? Didn't that get Moses in trouble way back in the desert?
You're remembering the story from Exodus perfectly.
Okay.
That golden calf incident became the symbol of, you know, straying from God's true path.
Right.
And centuries later, when the Northern Kingdom was established, their first king, Jeroboam, set up golden calves for worship in Bethel and Dan.
Okay.
Partly as like a power play to keep people from going to the temple in Jerusalem.
So it was a power play disguised as religious practice.
Exactly. But to many, it was straight up idolatry.
Right.
A huge offense in the eyes of those who remained faithful to the traditions centered in Jerusalem.
So picture this. You're a shepherd, used to quiet nights under the stars, tending your flock. And suddenly you're thrown into this politically and religiously charged environment.
Talk about culture shock.
Talk about culture shock, right?
Yeah, Dr. Wilson makes that contrast so vivid. This shepherd,
right,
used to simplicity, becomes this prophet challenging the very foundation of the Northern Kingdom's power structure.
That's pretty bold. Speaking of shaking things up, Amos timed his ministry to coincide with a major earthquake. It's almost like he's using this natural disaster to say, like, wake up. Pay attention. This is serious.
Absolutely. He actually dates his prophecies to 2 years before this earthquake.
Okay.
A massive one that was likely felt all the way from the Jordan Valley fault line.
Wow.
Down to the Dead Sea. Imagine the impact of that. It would have been a defining event for them, much like how we remember 9/11.
Oh, absolutely.
No.
Okay. So, and that leads us to the roar of the lion.
Right.
One of the most striking images in Amos's prophecies, he talks about the Lord roaring from Zion.
Yeah.
It sends chill down your spine just thinking about it.
It's not a literal lion, of course,
yeah,
but it's this powerful metaphor for God's judgment,
right,
that's about to be unleashed. This kind of vivid animal imagery was very common in prophetic literature.
Okay.
You know, it grabs your attention.
Right.
And forces you to pay attention.
So this divine judgment, who's it aimed at? Is it just directed at the Northern Kingdom's enemies, the bad guys, so to speak?
Well, that's where things take a turn.
Okay.
Amos delivers prophecies against 8 nations.
Wow, 8.
Starting with Damascus. Each time using this formula for 3 transgressions, yes, even for 4.
So it's not about specific numbers, right? It's more like enough is enough.
You got it. It's a literary device that you find in other ancient texts like Homer's epics or those Hittite battle accounts,
right,
that Dr. Wilson mentioned. It's just to emphasize how full the cup of wickedness has become.
Okay, so far so good. God's angry judgment is coming. But here's the twist, right? God doesn't just condemn Israel's enemies. He condemns Judah, the southern kingdom, and even Israel itself.
That's right.
Why? What did they do that was so bad?
Well, this is where Amos's message becomes incredibly relevant for us today.
Okay.
The real sin, the one that earns God's wrath, is inhumanity and social injustice. Each condemnation boils down to cruelty and violations of basic human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a stark reminder that true religion isn't just about rituals and offerings.
Right.
It's about how we treat each other, especially the vulnerable.
This makes me rethink what it means to be truly religious.
Right.
It's not just about showing up at services, is it?
Amos was furious at what he saw happening around him, war crimes, oppression of the poor, rampant greed, and he wasn't afraid to call out hypocrisy wherever he saw it, even within his own community.
It's like we're talking about a society that looks pretty religious on the surface, right? They have their rituals, their offerings, their golden calf.
Right.
But underneath it all, there's this rot of injustice and inhumanity.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And what's so powerful about Amos is that he doesn't just like point fingers. He uses these incredibly vivid images,
right.
You know, drawing on his life as a shepherd
mm-hmm.
and his deep understanding of history and tradition
right.
to drive his point home.
Give me an example. How does he weave history into his prophecies?
Well, Dr. Wilson points out that Amos mentions things like the Nazirite vow.
Okay.
And events from Israel's wilderness wanderings. He clearly had a deep knowledge of his people's past, even going back centuries.
But how would someone like Amos, a shepherd, have access to all that information? It's not like they had Google back then.
That's where the importance of oral tradition comes in.
Right.
Dr. Wilson talked about how in ancient Israel, families were the primary educators.
Yeah.
Stories, laws, wisdom, all of that was passed down.
Interesting.
Through generations. It was like having a living library in every household.
So those fireside chats we always wish we had more time for.
Exactly.
Right.
And then you had these 48 Levitical cities
okay.
scattered throughout the land. And these cities acted as centers of learning and teaching.
Oh, interesting.
So they played a crucial role in preserving tradition and knowledge. Since there wasn't a designated tribe of Levi, they were given these cities as compensation for not having their own territory.
Okay, so it's like a decentralized network of knowledge keepers.
Precisely. And then you had the wisdom tradition with sages offering practical advice, wrestling with life's big questions. Can you imagine those debates?
Oh, yeah.
Shepherd meets sage. What a conversation that must have been.
That would have been pretty interesting. Okay, so back to Amos and his message. You mentioned that he draws on nature a lot, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Since he spent his life outdoors, tending sheep, and even working with sycamore fig trees.
His prophecies are filled with images from the natural world.
Right.
Iron sledges, harvest carts,
mm-hmm.
a bird caught in a snare, a hungry lion stalking its prey.
Oh, wow.
He even opens his book with a drought saying, the pastures of the shepherds dry up and the top of Carmel withers.
Mount Carmel, isn't that where Elijah had that epic showdown with the prophets of Baal?
You're exactly right.
I'm remembering that story from Sunday school.
Mount Carmel was this incredibly fertile region,
right.
known for its vineyards and its abundant pastures.
Wow.
So by invoking its withering, Amos is making a powerful point. Even this blessed land
right.
can be struck down. Nowhere is safe from God's judgment.
It's like he's using a landmark that everyone knows and everyone can picture to drive home the gravity of the situation. But okay, let's get back to those eight nations Amos prophesies against. You said they're all condemned for inhumanity. But what does that look like in practice? What were their crimes?
Well, each nation is called out for different offenses, but the common thread is cruelty and exploitation.
Okay.
For instance, Damascus is condemned for threshing Gilead with sledges of iron.
Okay.
Which is essentially a brutal metaphor for their war crimes.
That's a pretty disturbing image. It's not just conquering. It's like inflicting unnecessary suffering.
Exactly. And Gaza is condemned for capturing entire populations and selling them into slavery. Tyre is criticized for breaking treaties and showing no mercy. It's a stark reminder that power without compassion
right.
is a very dangerous thing.
So it's not just about who wins the war. It's about how they conduct themselves.
Right.
How they treat the defeated, the vulnerable.
Precisely. And what's even more striking is that Amos doesn't let Judah and Israel off the hook.
Really?
He saves his harshest criticisms for his own people.
That's surprising. Aren't prophets supposed to be well pro their own people?
That's what makes Amos so different.
Yeah?
He's more concerned with God's justice than with national pride. He calls out hypocrisy wherever he sees it, even within his own community.
So what were Judah and Israel guilty of? Why were they on Amos's hit list?
For Judah, it was rejecting God's law and following false gods.
Okay.
He accuses them of abandoning the very covenant that defined their identity as a people.
And what about Israel? What earned their condemnation?
This is where we circle back to those themes of wealth disparity and social injustice that we talked about earlier.
Right.
Amos is furious at the rich who trample the heads of the poor into the dust of the earth.
Wow.
And deny justice to the oppressed. He describes them living in luxurious houses, decorated with ivory, indulging in feasts, while others are struggling to survive.
So it's not just being wealthy, it's actively exploiting the less fortunate.
Right.
Turns a blind eye to their suffering.
Exactly. He calls out those who cheat in the marketplace, rig the courts, and basically build their wealth on the backs of the poor.
Mm-hmm.
He condemns those who offer empty sacrifices while ignoring the cries of the needy.
And he even takes aim at their religious practices, right? Like that whole golden calf situation we talked about earlier.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like he's saying you can't worship a golden calf and ignore the suffering around you.
That's the heart of it.
Yeah.
Amos argues that true worship isn't about rituals or offerings.
Right.
It's about aligning your actions with God's will.
Right.
And that includes caring for the vulnerable and pursuing justice.
It's that age-old wisdom, actions speak louder than words. You can't claim to be a good person if you're perpetuating injustice.
And that message is just as relevant today as it was in Amos's time.
Right.
It challenges us to look beyond appearances and ask ourselves, are we truly living in a way that reflects our values? Mm. Are we contributing to a more just and compassionate world?
Wow. That's pretty heavy stuff. It's like Amos is holding up a mirror to our own society.
Yeah.
Forcing us to confront some uncomfortable truths.
He certainly doesn't sugarcoat anything.
Right.
And he doesn't let up either. Remember how he started his book with that image of a drought?
Right.
Well, he continues to use vivid imagery throughout his prophecies.
Okay.
Drawing on his experience as a shepherd and his keen observations of nature.
Okay, so give me another example. What kind of imagery does he use to get his point across?
Well, in one striking passage, he compares Israel's impending destruction to a basket of ripe summer fruit.
Mm.
Just as fruit reaches its peak ripeness right before it begins to decay,
right,
so too has Israel reached a point of no return.
Okay.
It's a powerful image of decline and inevitable consequences.
So it's not just about punishing. It's about a natural outcome of their actions.
Exactly.
What goes around comes around.
Amos isn't just delivering a message of doom and gloom. He's offering a warning.
Okay.
A chance for the people to change their ways before it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, look at what you've done. Look where you're headed. There's still time to turn things around.
But the big question is anyone listening? I mean, do the people actually heed his warnings? Yeah, it's like that saying, sometimes it's easier to just ignore the problem, you know, than to actually fix it.
Yeah.
Especially when you're comfortable, maybe even wealthy, and, you know, things seem good on the surface.
That's that human element that Dr. Wilson captures so well. You know, change is hard.
Right.
It can be disruptive, uncomfortable.
Right.
Even threatening, especially to those in power.
Right.
It's often easier to just kind of turn a blind eye and keep things as they are.
Yeah, why trade, you know, those beds of ivory and summer houses Amos was ranting about for a guilty conscience, right?
Exactly. And that brings us to, I think, a pivotal moment in the book.
Okay.
Amos's confrontation with Amaziah, the priest at Bethel.
Okay, this is where things get interesting. Set the scene for me. What happens?
So picture this. Amos is preaching at Bethel,
right,
this major religious center, and he's basically saying your fancy rituals and offerings mean nothing if you're exploiting the poor and ignoring God's call for justice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Amaziah doesn't take kindly to this.
I can imagine that's not exactly a message that's going to win you any popularity contests.
Right.
Especially with the religious elite.
Not at all. Amaziah tries to shut Amos down,
okay,
telling him to go back to Judah and prophesy there. He even accuses Amos of treason, saying the land cannot bear all your words.
Treason, that's a serious accusation. So Amos is literally seen as a threat to the establishment.
Precisely. And remember, this is a time when prophets could be viewed as having divine authority.
Right.
So their words carried a lot of weight.
Wow.
To challenge a prophet was essentially to challenge God himself.
Talk about high stakes. So how does Amos respond to Amaziah's threats? Does he back down?
He doesn't flinch. In fact, he doubles down. He basically tells Amaziah, look, I'm not some professional prophet looking for a paycheck. God called me from tending sheep to deliver this message, and I'm not going to be silenced just because you don't like what I'm saying.
That's really brave, standing up to the authorities like that. It reminds me of those activists throughout history, you know, who risk everything to speak truth to power.
It's a powerful reminder that courage and conviction can come from the most unexpected places.
Yeah.
You know, Amos, the simple shepherd,
right,
was willing to confront the religious and political elite because he believed in the message he was carrying.
It makes you think about who we listen to today and why.
Right.
Are we drawn to those flashy personalities, you know, and comfortable messages, or are we willing to listen to those people that challenge us even when it's uncomfortable?
That's the enduring legacy of Amos. I think he wasn't afraid to shake things up, to speak truth to power, even when it put him at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that message resonates just as strongly today as it did almost 3,000 years ago.
So Amos delivers this message even in the face of opposition. But what's the ultimate outcome? Does anything actually change?
Well, that's the tough part. Dr. Wilson doesn't sugarcoat it.
Okay.
He points out that despite Amos's warnings, the northern kingdom continues down this path of corruption and injustice.
Wow.
About 50 years after Amos prophesied, the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom.
Oh, wow.
Scattering the 10 tribes. It's a stark reminder that sometimes even the most passionate pleas for justice go unheeded.
So all that preaching, all that passion, and nothing changes? It's kind of a depressing ending.
Well, it can seem that way on the surface, but I think there's a deeper message here. Remember, prophets weren't just fortune tellers predicting the future.
Right.
They were messengers calling people back to a more just and righteous path.
Right.
Offering a chance for repentance and renewal.
So even though the Northern Kingdom ultimately fell, Amos's words still mattered.
Absolutely. Think about it. We're still talking about Amos today, thousands of years later.
Yeah, that's true.
His message continues to inspire and challenge us to build a more just and compassionate world.
It's like planting seeds, right? You may not see the fruits of your labor right away, but that doesn't mean your efforts were in vain.
Exactly. And Dr. Wilson left us with a powerful question to ponder.
Okay.
If the family was the main source of learning in ancient Israel, how do we pass on the values of compassion and justice in our own families and communities today?
Wow, that's a big question. How do we make sure those values aren't lost? It's a challenge for sure. But I think Amos would be proud to know that we're still wrestling with his message, still trying to figure out how to make it real in our own lives. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the world of Amos. We'll leave you with that question to ponder. Until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep diving deep. 3622.